So in these talks for the retreat, Andre and I are going over some of the basic foundational elements of mindfulness practice. And when I give my introductory instructions for mindfulness meditation, I often follow a sequence of starting with the breath, and then instructions on mindfulness of the body, and then mindfulness of emotions, and then mindfulness of thinking. And since there's four there, people have sometimes assumed that those were the four foundations of mindfulness. And in fact, the four foundations of mindfulness are a little different, as Andrea said last night. The body, which includes the body and the breath, are one foundation. And then there's a thing called feeling tone, the vedana. Very simple, whether it's things are pleasant or unpleasant. And then there's the state of mind, the overall mood or state or quality of the mind. It's third foundation. And then the dharmas, the teachings of the Buddha that's applied to the mind, or the different patterns by which the mind, forces or patterns of the mind which either keep us in bondage, keep us stuck in suffering, or help move us towards freedom. So today what I'd like to do is talk about emotions and mindfulness of emotions. So as you see, it's not one of the classic four foundations of mindfulness. And in fact, in the four foundations of mindfulness, you can't point to anything that specifically we would refer to the English idea of emotions. You could a little bit if you squeeze water out of gravel. But you'd have to work at it a little bit. You know, it's not included in... What we call emotions in English is not included in the foundation of the body. There's people sometimes that think it's the second foundation, because people sometimes call it mindfulness of feelings. And feelings, right, are sometimes synonymous with the word emotion. So there's sometimes confusion. But the vedana feeling tone is being very narrow and specific. It doesn't include all. It includes emotions, but not the emotional part. It includes the whether the emotion is pleasant or unpleasant, and whether the sensations of the body are pleasant or unpleasant, whether experiences of the mind are pleasant or unpleasant. So it's very particular. And you could squeeze maybe the third foundation of mindfulness a little bit to get to emotion, but it's a little bit hard-pressed to get the full range of emotions that we're familiar with. You might say, well, certain different emotional states come with particular qualities of mind, like the mind might be contracted or expansive. And so, but, you know, but still you can't really point to what we think of as emotions. And then you might, in the third foundation of mindfulness, say, well, the hindrances are there. So they're kind of emotions, aren't they? So yeah. But what about wonderful things like happiness, compassion, grief, sadness, despair, and confidence, and courage, and delight, and there's a whole, I mean, we can go on and on, there's a long list of emotions. So where do they fit? And it turns out that in the Pali, the ancient Buddhist language, it turns out there's no good word that translates the English word emotion. So that explains a lot about Buddhism. Right? you had your suspicion about these Buddhists. And that explains it. They don't have emotions. Now, of course, Buddhists have emotions. And of course, there's a lot of reference to the particular emotions in Buddhist texts, and 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 the goal of Buddhism is sometimes described as mahasukha, great happiness. Joy and happiness and delight are important parts of the path. The recognition that we're working to overcome the forces of grief and despair and fear and hate and many, emotions are there for sure. But the particular ones we find words for. But the overall category, emotion, because emotion is a category word, it's an abstract word, concept. That concept isn't quite there in Buddhism. And so you might ask why. I think that the ancient Indians were pretty much humans like we are. We're humans like they are. I don't think there's huge differences. Some differences for sure. Different cultures, different people. But how I see it is that you take all the different aspects, the specific aspects of being a human. We think, we have emotions, we have intentions, we have sensations in the body, we have experiences of pain and suffering and pleasure and all those particulars. And imagine you create a pie with those. And then you can divide up the pie different ways. And so in ancient India, they divided up the pie of human experience without a category called emotions, even though they had anger and happiness and all those things. It's like if, which is, it's not like they're wrong or right for dividing up the pie differently. It's just they measured it differently. Like we have the metric system of measurement and the English system of measurement. Which one is truer? I mean, that's the kind of a silly question. It's not, it just, you might ask which one's more efficient, but easier to use or something, but they're not, one's not truer than the other, it's just different ways of dividing up distance or measurement. But the reason I want to emphasize this is that among many people in the modern West, the topic of emotions and their relationships to emotions is really a big deal. And people will have manifestos about their opinions about emotions and what's supposed to happen to them. People are willing to kill for their emotions, their attitude, their beliefs around emotions. It's really something. So they have people who believe it, back in the 70s, those of you who were around then, you had to express it, cathart it. All those people around you, and then if you went to S, you were supposed to be yelled at, and you're supposed to, my mother did S when I was a teenager, and the only change I could, only difference I could tell from her before and after was that after she did S, I could swear in her presence. If you don't know what EST is, it was kind of human potential and growth movement. And so this cathart, get it all out there. And that was a kind of a reaction to that great philosophy of the 1950s, which was keep it in. Stoic, don't express anything. Cool. You're supposed to always stay cool. And there were all these repressed people going around. So they realized that, so then they wanted to go, they went to the other side and kind of cathart and express. And by the 1980s, they started realizing that expressing wasn't always such a good thing. And in fact, sometimes, what's what Buddhism teaches, if you do the same thing repeatedly, you develop a habit. So get your anger out. If it just meant expressing it every time you're angry, you can actually be reinforcing the patterns and the habits of being angry. But they were doing all those attitudes about beliefs about what had to happen around emotions. And people say that, people will say that person's, is pretty emotional, or you're too emotional. Maybe some of you have heard that people tell you that, you're too emotional, or you're not emotional enough, or, you're real repressed. So it's a category we use a lot. And so in Buddhism, classically in Buddhism, the ancient times, that wasn't a category. Emotion, emotional, as far as I can tell. So I think that's, maybe I say that all this hoping to challenge you a little bit to begin to, maybe to encourage you to look anew at this whole area of emotion. And be willing to question it or wonder, what is this, what I call emotions, if those of you who have them. In fact, what we call emotion in English are a variety of different things, and sometimes it's not so obvious what is an emotion and what isn't. There's it's a gray area. So, for example, is something like trust and confidence an emotion? Some people might say it is, and some people say, well, trust is an attitude, not an emotion. Is desire an emotion? Or is it just an intention? Just a mental desire. For it to be an emotion, there has to be some powerful movements of energy and sensations and feeling in the body. So, maybe lust qualifies as an emotion. But, desiring seconds at lunch, that's not quite an emotion. So when is desire an emotion, when isn't? How does this work? But then if we look at particular emotions, it seems that emotions are composite events that are made up of many particular aspects, streams of our life that come together. As Andrea said yesterday about pain, pain also is a composite. Many different things come together for us to experience what we call pain. And when we experience pain, we often think of it as being unitary. The pain can be quite intense, and so it's one thing, my pain. But people who've studied the physiology and psychology of pain, some of them will list 10 different factors that come into play, physical and psychological, emotional, cognitive factors that come into play. And then they'll rate the intensity of each of those 10. And the intensity from 1 to 10. And the intensity, so say that you have... some terrible, sharp stomach pains. I mean, it's really clear. I mean, you're in pain, you're sweating, it's really intensely painful. And one of the factors can be your beliefs around that pain. So you haven't had it diagnosed yet, so the belief is, this must be one of those rare, incurable, parasitic worms that's going to eat me up, put me inside out. And before I know it, I'll be just, all liquid inside. And so there's this fear around what it is. And the fear is a 10 on the scale of 1 to 10. And so there's 10 of these different factors that come into play. And the scientists say when they take these 10 different things, you measure them on a scale of 1 to 10, you have to have one way or the other get to 70. You add them all up together in order for it to be pain. But it doesn't matter which of the 10. So for example, say you're up to 72 in the total, right? And so, but you have this like number 10, you're up on 10 about this parasitic worm in your belly. That must be what it is. And you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, "Oh, that's nothing. It looks to me like you just had a little bit too many beans for lunch, and just a little bit of gas, and you'll be fine." And suddenly, the fear about the dire consequence of what this pain means and what's going to vanishes right just like that. So it goes from 10 to 0. So now you're down to 62, and so then the pain is no longer there. some of the other things are still there, the pressure in your belly and all this stuff. So I don't know if you could follow that, but the point being that pain is a composite. There's many different things that stream together. And the mind wraps it all together into one unitary thing. But if you begin looking very carefully at pain, you see some of the different streams that go in. And some of them have to do with beliefs and fear. Some have to do with memories and associations. Some of them have to do with the actual physical sensation that's happening. And it's not necessary, it's not so unitary, and it's possible to start breaking it up and start having a different relationship to it. That's why one of the reasons why, if you're mindful in a non-reactive way, that changes one of those 10 factors, which is the degree to which we react towards it. So I had the experience of my early retreats having a lot of knee pain. And I saw very clearly that if I felt self-pity, poor Gil, that I would, the muscles around my knee would contract and I'd feel more pain. Or if I had aversion to the pain, the muscles in my knee would contract and have more pain. And so I had to be very attentive to watch my reaction. And I learned that my reactivity affected how much pain I felt. And before that, before I'd meditated, I'd never imagined that I participated in the intensity or degree to which I felt pain. So there were other factors involved besides my contraction, but around it. But so the same thing with emotions. Emotions are composite events. It's often useful to see it that way. They're made up of many different things coming together. So an emotion, for example, can be can involve a physical sensations in the body. It's hard to know that you're having an emotion sometimes unless you feel the sensations in your body. You can feel heat when you're angry. You can feel contraction maybe in your belly when you're afraid. If you feel love and compassion, you can feel maybe soft in your chest and your heart area perhaps. If you're depressed, you know, you feel the energy just drops and you feel like almost no energy in your body. So there's all kinds of ways you feel in your body. There's sensations in your body that come into play. There are intentions that are part of many emotions. Maybe not all emotions, but they're intentions. And so when you were angry, maybe there's an intention to strike out, to push away. If there is, if there's a strong desire, there's a desire to have something. If there's fear, there's the intention to recoil and pull back. If there is hate, maybe the intention to push down and destroy. If there, if there's delight, maybe it comes along with the intention to go out and enjoy, to enjoy it more. So many emotions come together with an intention or a wish as part of it, or a movement towards something or away from something as part of it. There can be an evaluation that's a part of the emotion. Remember, it comes to mind now that when I was in the Zen monastery, we ate in the meditation hall in a choreographed way where there was a lot of bowing. People would come and bring you a pot of the food and serve you in your bowl as you're sitting in meditation posture like this. You sit like this, you have a bowl like this in front of you. Servers would come and they'd dump food in your bowl and then they'd go to the next person. And when they served you, before they served you, they had to bow and you had to bow to them. And after they served you, when they finished serving, you had to bow to each other again. It's a very nice idea, like thank you or recognition. But we did this, for years, Every day we bow, 3 times a day, and do this whole thing. And it became very consequential to me how deeply they bowed. And I would feel emotions. If they bowed really deeply, that I evaluated that one way. And if they did a little nod, I evaluated that as as a form of disrespect, you know, of not really caring or not liking me or something. And so I do this evaluation, and then with the evaluation would come, you know, anger or resentment or despair, or hopelessness or fear, you know, all these emotions would come through. And who knows what was going on for them. Maybe they had a bad back that day and they could hardly bend over at all. Or maybe they didn't like me. You know, it's okay. But I've made everything such a big deal. And so I could see the emotion I had an evaluation as part of evaluating what this meant. So one of the things we can do with emotions is begin looking more carefully and see what are the different pieces that make up this experience and not treat it as a unitary thing. And so this is, I think, where the frames of reference that Andrea talked about yesterday can be helpful, where the four foundations of mindfulness can be helpful. Because we can look at emotions from these different perspectives. We can look at it, for example, when we have an emotion, how is it being experienced in the body as sensations? And it's often very helpful to drop down in your body and feel it in emotion in your body. It does a number of things. One of the things it does is that it keeps you out of your story about the, and a good percentage of the time, emotions arise because of stories or evaluations or judgments that we have about situation. Most people, I believe most people in the modern world, modern West probably, modern world, the emotions they have are secondary, not primary emotions. And what I mean by secondary is that they're emotions that arise out of an evaluation, out of a story we tell ourselves. So for example, if the mountain lion does show up here, at Tassajara in the Zendo. Zendo was maybe twice as big as this room once. And it was during a 7-day silent retreat. And at 10 o'clock in the morning, the abbot was giving the Dharma talk, but the windows were open, really open, no screens. And a bobcat jumped in. The SPCA, it was a baby bobcat, and the SPCA was saved it somehow, and thought they were driving it deep into the wilderness. And so they left it at that time, that, you know, 7 miles down this dirt road in Los Padres National Wilderness. And so the bobcat just followed the road to the end, which was the monastery. And you know, I'm just used to people, so it jumped in. So, you know, so the mountain lion comes along, you know, down the street or jumps in here. You know, and I suspect that I would hope that most of you would have a healthy fear that the mountain lion jumped in. You know, oh, I'm supposed to let go and be calm. Yes, it helps to be calm, for sure. But I think, you know, if you weren't, you know, I think it's pretty normal, you know, if the bobcat jumps in the room, to have, you know, that's a fear, and that's a primary fear. Worry, on the other hand, is secondary emotion. Because that requires an evaluation, a story, a projection, a fantasy. You know, I worry about something. I worry that the mountain lion jumps in here, into this room while I'm giving a Dharma talk. I will not behave in a Dharma teacherly manner. And I'll be busted. And you'll realize that, you know, I'm not really as deeply practiced as you thought I should be. And so I might sit here and worry and worry, you know. So I could just feel my worry, accept my worry, or I can just get real, you know. And look, Gil, you know, get off this whole thing about having to prove yourself as a Dharma teacher and just get on with the talk. So many emotions that people have come out of an evaluation. Some of those evaluations started years ago, stories and events, and some of them are deeply conditioned as habits that are almost built into the structure of our way we think, the way we kind of see ourselves and hold ourselves. And it's not just like we're not actively telling ourselves a story anymore now. The story is like in the subconscious. It's deeply kind of layered into our neurons almost. But still, it's an evaluation, a story that's there. So when you turn your attention to the physical expression of the emotion, it's a way of helping you not get hooked into the story. And I think it's really helpful not to be hooked in and spin the story even more. And probably some of you had the experience, I've had the experience of sitting, minding my own business, meditating, having a good time, relatively. Peaceful, nice. Things are calm, relatively. And then, uninvited by me is a thought, a memory of what happened in the high school prom. You know, and how could she have, and poof! You know, I mean, it's like an explosion inside of emotions and feelings and anger, and it's been 30 years. You know, I hadn't thought about her for 30 years, and poof! You know, the evaluation comes in. So I could stay with the story and repeat it and rehearse it and figure out what I should have done. Or I could pull myself out of the story and then feel what's going on in the body. Feel the anger, feel the energy, feel the agitation, feel what's happening. So on one hand, it helps us to disentangle from the story. The other thing that I hope it does, and maybe this requires some intention on your part, I like to see it as a movement that's very respectful of the emotion we're having. I believe that all emotions should be respected, that no emotion should be dismissed or pushed away or said, you shouldn't be having this or this is bad or whatever. I think all emotions are something that are there for causes and conditions. They all speak to some deeper movement and deeper human connectedness or human something that's going on. And that no emotion should ever be dismissed. But emotions can be learned from or can be purified or worked through or composted or can be winnowed. Is that the right word? Winnowed. So that the chaff falls off and we see the seed that's inside of it. And I think that the role of vipassana practice is to learn to be respectful. And I like the word respect a lot because it means in Latin roots of it, it means literally respect, to look again. So with vipassana, we look again, look more carefully, what is this? Don't be dismissive. But it helps if you're not blinded or caught up in the stories. Because usually stories are not about here and now. But what's happening in your body is here and now. So what happened in the prom is ancient. But the fire and anger that comes up here in the body, that's now. So let me feel that. So I think it's very respectful to do that. It's also respectful of how many, many times, my belief is all the time, is that our inner life knows how to process our emotions, knows how to help them move through and clear out. As you know, I like to teach that emotions, the word Latin root for emotions means to move out. E means out, motion means motion. No emotion is ever static. It's fixed. It's always a process. Emotions are not things. They're processes that are in motion, that are happening, unless we freeze them. And many people have frozen emotions. Resentment is frozen anger. Charlie Brown had good grief. But bad grief is when the grief gets frozen, which is easy to do. But how do we get it to move again? How do we get it to move? How can we trust the natural unfolding, the natural processing? For me, being a little bit kind of a religious type, maybe, I like to believe that all emotions, what they want to do is move towards freedom. They want to free themselves. They move towards peace and freedom. If we get out of the way. So part of what helps by coming, feeling it in your body and not being in the story, it can help get out of the way of more further evaluations, reactivities to it. And just feel it in your body. So you feel the burning in your belly or the tightness in your chest or the constriction around your eyes or in your neck or wherever it might be that the emotion is being felt. And just hold it there very openly or allowingly. Give it permission to be there. An image that I like sometimes with difficult emotions is kind of the image of holding, putting your hands out, cupping your hands like in the bowl, very gently and openly, and holding your hands and allowing the emotion to rest in the hands. So it might be very difficult, maybe it's hard to even approach, but you kind of bring the hands of your awareness underneath it. So you're not directly at it, but underneath, just hold it there. So you're there with it. You offer it your presence. You're there and you feel it. And so sometimes you go directly at it or to feel it. It's too much sometimes, but sometimes just underneath. Or sometimes if it's too much, the image, another image is to imagine that awareness is soft cotton gauze and soft cotton balls. And you just gently touch the edges of the sensation in your body. And just touch it just lightly, you know, like a wound that's, you know, you want to touch it really lightly with a cotton ball so it doesn't hurt, you know, just touch it lightly. Then you pull back and you touch it lightly. And that's all you need to do, very, very tenderly. You don't have to go, you know, this is not like the kamikaze approach to mindfulness, you know. I feel some strong emotion, let me just, you know, dive right into it and, you know, attack it. Make it very gentle, feel it. Allow it to be there. Trust it. Trust it to be there. Trust it, you know, being present for it, for what you can. And meditation, I think, is one of the really great places to do this. Because, you know, in real life, daily life out there, I guess this is not so real. Well, that's the implication, but when I said that. But in life out there, in the, you know, work and friends and family, I mean, then you have to be kind of wise about the emotions that you allow to be and how you are with it. But this meditation is one of the safest places on the planet to let your emotions rip, to let them come and show themselves and show themselves what they are and move through you. Because, you know, you're kind of, when you're meditating, you're kind of committed to not moving. So if you feel murderous rage, you know, you're kind of like committed to not to move. You're sitting there and, you know, let the fire kind of burn you up. And, you know, I've had, you know, extreme restlessness. And once I got into it with my mindfulness, it got to be kind of fun. You feel the restlessness like these ping pong balls bouncing around inside the body. Just wondering where the ball was going to bounce next. And whereas I know that if outside, if I wasn't meditating, if I was restless, you know, not only can I just kind of be all jittery, but I might even do something unskillful with the restlessness. So, to allow it to be, it's okay. Sometimes people in the Buddhist circles, people somehow or other get the message that you're not supposed to have certain emotions when you're in Buddhist circles, and. You know, and one of the favorite emotion to believe you're not supposed to have if you're a Buddhist is anger. Because we're supposed to be kind, always loving kindness. You know, just do metta.
Just do metta for those people.
It's good to do metta, even when you're angry, but But not as a way of repressing or denying. It's really good to have some space in your life to let the emotions be there freely and allow them to be. So one of the things, so one aspect of this, you know, frames of reference is to look at the bodily experience and to look at it carefully. What are the particular sensations that make up an emotion? Remember once I asked some person on a retreat, I asked her, you know, how are you feeling the emotion she was feeling? I forget what it was. Where are you feeling it in your body? So I feel it in my shoulders. And then how do you feel it in your shoulders? And she said, it feels like heavy football pads. You see, like football uniforms, you know, heavy pads. And I thought that was interesting that she had that as an image. But I said to her, that's fine, that's an image, but those image is not a sensation. What's the actual sensation? And the sensation was heaviness. And then once you identify the heaviness, go in and feel the heaviness. You know, because it's possible, it's very easy to kind of see something a little bit at a distance, but not really kind of study it. So where do you feel the head? Is it in the surface of the skin? Is it deep inside? Is it the front of the shoulders, the back of the shoulders? You know, where is it? How big a space is the heaviness, or the tightness, or the constriction, or the warmth, or the whatever it might be? So with your attention, your awareness, it can be interesting to go and feel more carefully. Partly as we feel it more carefully, it's kind of like not to interfere with it, but the more clearly you can see something, sometimes the more clearly it has an opportunity to move and be freed up and do what it needs to do. The more clearly you feel something, the less you are in the valuation in the story. And it becomes simpler, a lot simpler. So sometimes when you go and feel the sensation of an emotion in the body, it begins to change and morph. It actually sometimes processes quicker if you feel it carefully. And sometimes it moves around. It changes from one emotion to another. And your task as a meditator is to just follow that. Trust the movement as it goes. Another frame of reference for emotions is the second foundation, which I'll just mention briefly now, save the rest of it for another time. But it's the simple recognition, it's looking at an experience, any experience at all, and seeing is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. And it turns out that all experiences have one of those three flavors. And some people find that by identifying which of those flavors the experience has, it simplifies the experience and it helps them to shift their relationship to the experience so they're not so caught by it. Some experiences are amazingly complex in all the different cause and effect things going on. You know, your history and all your conditioning and all the people you're with and who said what to who and why and what has to happen. And, you know, you can get confused by all the different things. But you say, oh, I'm in this crowd of all these people and all the stuff is going on. This is unpleasant. Suddenly it's gotten simple. And what's interesting is many times our reactivity to situations often arises out of the simplicity of its pleasant and unpleasant nature. So when you have a strong emotion, sometimes it's interesting to look, is this pleasant or unpleasant? And how am I with the unpleasantness? How am I with the pleasantness? I've had very pleasant meditations on retreat. And I don't just let it be pleasant. I get into having these amazingly rich discussions with myself about how I'm going to plan more retreats, how I'm going to tell all my friends how important it is that they should go on retreat, go tell my family, and I start living in this cloud, this virtual world of conversations and thoughts and planning around all built out of the fact that it's just pleasant. And then I come back for the next sitting, and I'm miserable. What happened? I was happy one, you know, it's going well, one sitting, the next sitting, I'm miserable. And so then there's the evaluation. I must have done something wrong during our walking period. I blew it. I wasn't careful enough. I don't know how to do this meditation. I shouldn't be here. I'm a Buddhist failure. I hope no one notices. This is terrible. I better figure out some way to run away from this retreat center. But so no one notices me. And I get involved in that kind of world. But it's the whole world that I got involved in was triggered by my aversion to the unpleasantness of a difficult meditation. But if I just let it be difficult, oh, this is unpleasant. Sometimes it can be a lot easier. It's just unpleasant. I'll just keep doing, practicing the best I can, and let it be unpleasant. So emotions also that way. Some emotions are pleasant, some are unpleasant. And sometimes the reactivity we have to it has to do with just that, pleasant or unpleasant. Some emotions come with states of mind. And to be very simple for today, one of the states of mind mentioned by the Buddha is a contracted state of mind, constricted. Another one is an expansive, spacious state of mind. So some emotions help us get more constricted. We feel claustrophobic. Some make us feel more expansive and open. And sometimes you can feel, it's interesting to look at that. What effect has this emotion had on my state of mind, my state of consciousness? And sometimes it's very interesting to look at that and realize what's happened. And sometimes just looking at it from that point of view helps us to step back a little bit and not be so entangled and caught up in the emotion. Or we can look at it from the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And we can look at it from the point of view of, there's a number of things to look at there, but we can look at it from the point of view, one of the fourth foundations is called the knot. It's called usually in English, the fetter, the knot. There is someone who's snorting in the meditation hall, and there's the hearing of the snorting, and then between the sound of the snorting and you somehow hearing it, somewhere in that mix, there's a knot that gets formed. You've gotten entangled with it. There's no requirement to get entangled with snorting. It's just snorting. But you've gotten entangled. You've gotten caught up. You get indignant, self-righteous, despairing. Doesn't this person realize that this is my precious meditation time? I'm on the brink of enlightenment where I'm going to have compassion for all beings. And that person is interfering with my progress. And so we picked it up. We've gotten entangled. We've gotten involved with it. And it's fairly common on retreats for people to come to me and say, you have to talk to that person in the hall. The person has a Velcro jacket. Person comes in late, doesn't take off his or her shoes, stomps across the meditation hall, arrives out of breath, and then decides to take off the Velcro jacket. And then 5 minutes later, takes the water bottle and guzzles. And then decides to put the jacket on again. And this sound is interfering with my meditation. And I feel indignant. So generally, I mean, sometimes teachers will say, go talk to someone, and say, you know, please, don't bring your coffee in the meditation hall. But generally we say, why don't you bring your mindfulness on that? And to see what's going on for you. Just be mindful of hearing and your reaction. And usually what happens at the next interview, the practitioner will come back and say, oh, it's a lot better now. And I'll ask, what happened? The person stopped whatever they were doing. No, they continued. But now it's just sound. And the sound just passes right through me. And in fact, occasionally they'll say, not only that, but now I use it as a mindfulness spell. It just helps me, reminds me to be mindful. So what's happened is the person has gone from being entangled, knotted up in the experience, to being unknotted, to being free of the experience. So one of the things to do when there's an emotion, because so many of our emotions are evaluative in nature, they're not because of the mountain lion. They're story and events and history and background, momentum from the past. One of the things to do is to go in and look, where's the knot? How am I entangled? Where am I caught in this thing, this experience? And are there particular desires that I have that are being frustrated? Are there particular aversions that are being challenged? So are there certain expectations that I'm living by? Are there beliefs that are operating here? And I'm caught by my beliefs. Where's the entanglement? And not to spend a lot of time analyzing and reviewing your whole history of your life to come to this, but because these things, the knot is something visceral happening right now. And one of the ways to kind of access it is, again, going back into your body and feel, is there any constriction, any holding anywhere? And sometimes you can almost feel, when you're really strongly knotted up around something, you can actually feel it as a physical pressure, tightness, constriction, something, holding, frozenness, something. And then when you feel it, can you feel it physically, then just whenever you feel something physically and you can't kind of relax it easily, it's so helpful just to hold it kindly, openly, gently. Just hold it with your open hands. And sometimes the and respect it. So even if you're knotted up and entangled and caught and attached, I think it's really, really important to have a lot of respect for your attachment. One of the problems of Buddhism, I feel, how it's heard, is sometimes if you feel like you have an attachment or some clinging, well, then you're not a good Buddhist. And so, heaven forbid, you admit it to other people. But even to yourself, you're supposed to get rid of it. But I think it's actually much wiser if you can identify some place that you're attached and look at it with respect, hold it with respect, see it more clearly. Because there's something very powerful that happens when we see clearly what's going on. One of the things is that we learn what's there. We bring things into consciousness. And it allows for some separation of, or some easing by itself. Things can let go of themselves if we get out of the way. And looking at things respectfully is one way of getting out of the way. It's not making it a big project to free yourself. Make it a project to see respectfully, to feel respectfully what's there. So one of the evaluations, so it's this entanglement, you know, so this fourth foundation is looking at it from the perspective, the frame of reference of, for example, of are we entangled with something. Another frame of reference in the fourth foundation is to look at it from the point of view of what is the selfing that's going on? What kind of self are we creating? What kind of self are we building up around this experience? And it's very interesting that part of the composite nature of many emotions that are secondary emotions, not the primary ones, one of the streams that goes on, that comes together to create it, is the wonderful evaluation that we have of who I am, the self-concept that we live by. And everyone has a self-concept, but often our self-concept is a troublemaker for us. It's often not very accurate, and even if it's accurate, often it's held really tightly in a way that we're not fluid and relaxed with how things are. We get entangled. Creates the knots very easily. So one of the interesting things to do around emotions is to see what is the self-concept, sense of self that's operating when I'm having this emotion. So for example, if there's guilt, the self is bad. If there is fear, the self is threatened. So if it's a mountain lion, you know, that's secondary, but that's primary. But the secondary, you know, so for example, if it was the case that my self-identity was closely tied to my car, and I left Hidden Villa today in my wonderful car, you know, all the dust in the parking lot just blew all over it, and it got all dusty and brown. And then I'm driving home, and people I know see me driving on the freeway, this dusty old car. And you know, how are they going to know who I truly am? My true self is completely connected to my car, right? And you know, my status in society. And so now I feel despairing. Or no one's seen me yet, but there's all this fear. Someone's going to see me in this dusty old car. So there's this fear, but that fear arises out of a sense of self that's being threatened. So fear here, this a threatened self. Anger, maybe a threatened self sometimes. Maybe anger is a hurt self. My sense of self has been jeopardized. If someone sees me in that dusty old car and says to me, you're not quite the man I thought you were. Then I'm threatened. So then I get angry, perhaps. So the anger there arises out of a sense of self, self-concept. Despair, hopelessness. I don't have what it takes. I can't manage. I something. And so part of what Dharma practice is to go back and look at the self-concept that's operating and question it and see, is it possible to relax it or not have it operating? There are some self-concepts which are accurate enough to have, but you know, a fist is a useful thing to have occasionally. But please don't go around with a fist all the time. Open your hand sometimes. Don't go around always with a fist of self, holding on to a concept of self in a tight way. Part of the function of meditation, part of what we're trying to do in meditation, is to release the fist in the mind that we're holding to relax, to soften. So we can look at emotions from all these different perspectives. And I think, you know, so I offer this to you today because if you have some emotions that are keeping you from really being present, you can turn towards them respectfully, and then without a lot of thought, but just kind of look, feel your way in the dark around them. Say, what's going on here? What are the different aspects here? What's going on physically? Feel it in your body. What's going on with the pleasant and unpleasant quality? What's happened with the overall state of my mind? How am I knotted? Am I caught or attached to something? What's the concept of self that's operating as I have this emotion? Don't do a lot of thinking about it, but it might be by just bringing your awareness, intentions, looking. You start breaking up the unitary, solid feeling. Emotion is just an emotion. But emotions can be very much respected. I think to me, emotions are kind of like the breath, like breathing. The other day I talked about the breath as being kind of like at the crossroads of so many different aspects of our life. I think emotions also are at the crossroads of so many different aspects of our life. So it's really a rich area of being present for. And then the final thing I'll say is that there are beautiful emotions that are primary emotions, that as we relax and soften and able to stay more present, more fully, and able to resolve or heal some of the ancient beliefs and feelings, emotions that have troubled us for a lifetime. Let them finally, kind of let the soft cotton balls kind of touch them and hold them and let them relax. That at some point, the primary feelings of joy and happiness, peace, of compassion, of love, can move through us as primary things. It's just kind of not because of evaluations, not because of stories we tell ourselves, but because the heart is open and sensitive and receptive to this life around us. The capacity to feel emotions is the doorway to allowing the deeper flow of beautiful emotions to come through us. Some people experience their life very much through their emotions. Some people, emotions are not a big thing. You know, different people, different genetics, different cultures, whatever. So don't feel in this giving this talk today that now you're supposed to be like a super emotional person if you're not. But when they come, be mindful of them. Include them as part of the meditation. Meet them with respect and hopefully learn that your capacity for attention, for mindfulness, for being aware can help you from being caught by what's happening. And in not being caught, you set things free. May your emotional life be set free. Let's take a minute to regather.